Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungekar. After over 50 years of operation, the University of Missouri Press is expected to close. The press is expected to begin phasing out operations over the next 6 months. Opponents of the decision have rallied in support of the press, but the scenario raises a whole host of larger questions. What benefits does an academic press offer to its host university and to society in general? What could we also expect other presses to do in our current financial situation? Today on Intersection, we'll talk about the future of university presses. Joining us today is a panel that could help shed light on the future of academic publishing. Claire Wilcox is the editor-in-chief of the University of Missouri Press. Claire, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Nancy Redeker is the director of the Truman State University Press. Nancy, thank you for joining us
today. Thank you.
And Tom Quirk is a professor of English here at MU. He's published several books through the UM Press, including a series on Mark Twain. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for being here.
And we hope to be joined shortly by Richard Brown. He's the director of Georgetown University's Press and a former board member for the Association of American University Presses. And we hope to hear from you in the audience as well. Do you think university presses are important? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can join our online chat. Now, I just want to pose that question to our panel here. What does a university press offer to its host university? Why is it important?
Well, I think in formal terms, a university press reinforces the university's traditional goals of teaching, research, and service in all of those aspects. And the fourth that's been added most recently, contributing to the state's, in our case, the state's economic engine, that is to help with the economy of the state. We also contribute in that way. We obviously publish scholarly books. We disseminate scholarly work and research. That work fosters other work, leads to more research. And in that way, we contribute to the research goal. We also we publish books that help teachers and help teaching. In fact, probably our best-selling book is a fourth-grade textbook on the history of Missouri that's used throughout the state. And it's also true that many of our other books are used either as textbooks in colleges or also as ancillary texts in graduate courses. And, of course, we perform a service for both the state and the university. We promote the university. All of our books have the university's name on them. They go all over the world. They're distributed in Europe, in the Pacific Rim, Canada, South America, everywhere, taking the name of the university out there. And because we also do books that help with the tourism of the state, we contribute to the economic well-being of the state and commerce in that way. Many small gift shops and all the state parks sell our books. We are probably, the premier publisher of books about the culture and history of Missouri. And you will find our books in Arrow Rock. You will find them at all of the state parks.
So there are a variety of benefits. One's economic. The other rooted in scholarship, both among academics and in the classroom setting. From a university's perspective, you mentioned that it brings prestige, it gets their name out there. How do universities evaluate that and make sure that their contribution is worth the investment is worth it in terms of the prestige it brings in? Are there any firm metrics that university administrations or administrators use?
Well, certainly we have everything is peer reviewed. So before we actually publish a book, we usually send it to two outside readers who are experts in their field or in their area, and so it is peer reviewed first of all, and then it is also accepted or approved by our editorial board before we publish it, you know, before we decide to just publish it. Then, of course, after it's published, we have editorial reviews or book reviews that are done in various scholarly journals that are appropriate for that particular book. So there are those kinds of ways that we do get some feedback for our books. Also, of course, sales are part of that, but scholarly books would have a smaller revenue than a commercial or a popular book would.
I think you've touched upon this, Claire, but what would, say, non-academics, normal people get out of university presses? What benefits do they see?
Well, almost every university press publishes not only scholarly books, but also regional trade books, in our case, that help preserve the culture and history of the state and inform people across the state about the area they live in or the region. A good example from our list would be the Missouri Heritage Readers. These are small books. There are now about 27 of them, and they address topics within Missouri history and culture. The most recent one actually is about the prison down in Jefferson City. That's now closed. You can take tours there, but it that's one instance of the kinds of book we do, or the Cherokee Trail of Tears across Missouri, or Blind Boone here in Columbia. We have books on all of these subjects within that series, and those books are read by the general public. Those aren't scholarly books in that sense. If we mean by scholarly books, books written by scholars for scholars, these are often books written by scholars for the general public.
And I do want to go into the breakdown of what percentage of university press publications are scholarly and meant for a larger audience. But before we get to that, I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungekar. On today's show, we're talking about the future of university publishing. Our guests in the studio today are Claire Wilcox, editor-in-chief of the University of Missouri Press, Nancy Rediger, the director of the Truman State University Press, and MU professor of English, Tom Quirk. And I do want to get to the other side of the equation. What do authors and academics at the home universities get out of the press?
Well, university presses are de facto implicated in a whole kind of review process nationally. That is, in cases of promotion and tenure and other sorts of prizes, if you will. University presses are part of that process. Now, it may not be that they are exclusively for University of Missouri professors to go to University of Missouri Press, say, but maybe Illinois or Dartmouth or whatever. But we're all doing, in some way, working in tandem for maintaining a certain level of scholarship by way of reading manuscripts, publishing manuscripts, and the rest. So there is that larger and somewhat invisible aspect, and certainly invisible to people who are not acquainted with what presses do. And I'm afraid that too few people know what presses do. For example, the History of the University of Missouri, published by a former president it's a big book, probably 600 pages. It's published by the University of Missouri Press. Well, no one else would publish it. They wouldn't have the interest. But it does, in fact, provide an archive history of this institution. Same way with the History of the Journalism School. So it serves multiple functions in rather invisible ways, but I think very important ways, certainly for the scholars.
And how does a press determine what types of books they publish? Is it pretty standard across different universities, or is there a way they focus their but they publish?
No, they have specialties out of necessity. We call it niche publishing, in fact. So in order to acquire books and to market them effectively, to you really need to focus on certain specialties. In our case, we try to draw some of them from the university's strengths. So, for instance, we have a list in journalism studies. We also have a series in Mark Twain studies, that, and Tom is the editor, scholarly editor of that series. We also have published books on Langston Hughes, you know, a native of Joplin, the collected works of Langston Hughes. So we don't simply do books about Missouri. Some of the other areas in which we work are American history, military history. We also do books in political science, various kinds of literary criticism. But if we get too far outside that niche, then we find we become less effective in publishing in all of its aspects, and certainly less effective in marketing it and reaching the intended audience.
Okay, and Nancy at Truman State?
Well, we publish in American Studies, which is a broad category for regional types of studies as well, things that, again, wouldn't get published by a larger commercial publisher. We also publish early modern studies, and the way that developed was that one of our faculty members brought the 16th Century Journal to our campus and was the managing editor for it. And out of that grew producing publishing books, and we are one of the book publishers in early modern studies as a result. And then we also have a poetry series, so and that sort of grew out of our our T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry. And in addition to publishing the winning manuscript, we publish other poetry manuscripts as well. Those are the areas that we focus on. Also, again, as Claire said, to help with acquisitions and marketing and just even efficiencies in copy editing and working with the same with authors and so forth. So it helps to streamline things a little bit more and make us more efficient as a overall as a press.
Mm-hmm. But in determining those focus areas, I guess what do individual presses look at?
Strengths of faculty members. And there are certainly ways that faculty members want to get involved or are already involved in a number of projects. And sometimes they'll come to us with projects. Occasionally we would publish a professor on our campus, but it would have to be in one of the areas that we specialize in as well.
Okay. And actually, I believe we have a call right now. Donna from Kansas City?
Yeah, I'm Donna Potts from Kansas State University, and I'm the chair of the Assembly of State Conferences for American Association of University Professors. And, should I go ahead and give my comment now?
Oh, please, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was just going to say that the press is such an essential part of the mission of the university. I mean, universities were founded for the advancement of learning in the first place, and I was just devastated to learn about this. I was also born in Joplin, Missouri, and so was Langston Hughes. So for that reason as well, Tom Quirk is a former professor of mine, and Claire Wilcox and I were in grad school together, and I'd certainly like to do everything I can to support the press right now, and to say, too, that I think the faculty should be heard on this issue. It's really a violation of governance to do this kind of thing without their meaningful consultation. So I hope the decision can be reversed. Thanks.
Actually, Donna, while I have you on the line, what do you think the UM system or just different universities could lose from a press closing down?
I think it really hurts their reputation. I mean, part of the mission is supposed to be research, and it hurts the reputation of the whole university for something like this to happen. I mean, the University of Missouri Press shouldn't have been a vanity press just to publish faculty members. It should have much more widespread appeal, and it has.
And is that typically has that been the case with other university presses, where it kind of serves the function of promoting faculty members and being seen as like a tenure, a means to get tenure?
I think excellent presses, certainly they go beyond their own faculty members and publish things that are of value internationally even. So.
Well, we also have a chat room question. What impact will the closing of the press have on the accreditation of the university?
That remains to be seen, I guess. I don't know how it figures.
Should I say more? I know that with accreditation, there in Washington, D.C., I know that the National AUP has worked on this issue, and more they're looking at the level of faculty governance when they're trying to determine accreditation. So I think it could be more harmful to the university now than ever before.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in, Donna.
Thanks a lot.
All right. I just kind of want to explore your perspective, Tom. So you did publish through the UM Press. Have you published elsewhere?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I published both commercial and university presses, probably 15, maybe.
And from an author's perspective, I mean, what do you look for when you're vetting different presses, or considering different presses, rather?
Whether they have a reputation in the subject matter at hand, whether it's appropriate to the subject. In the case of Twain, it seemed a natural place. I mean, I sometimes get calls from Washington because they want a quote from Twain, not because of me, but they think, oh, Missouri, that must be the place. So Twain is naturally associated with Missouri. So it seemed an appropriate, not only to publish there, but to get other people to publish on Mark Twain. Same thing with Langston Hughes and T.S. Eliot, another Missouri writer, and I don't know how many people know that, but there's a certain kind of sense of a citizen of the state, even though I'm not from Missouri. Missouri has a very rich literary history, and they should be proud of it and do their measure of enhancing and endorsing that history.
Okay, and I kind of want to look beyond Missouri. What's the general state of university presses at other institutions? Are they under increased scrutiny from the university?
I think they probably are, but according to Peter Beidler, the executive director of our AAUP, that is the Association of American University Presses, no other presses he knows of are being threatened with closure at this time. University presses, as long as I've worked for one, and it's been 23 years now, have always been concerned about making sure that they weren't a financial drain on their university, that they were making contributions, that they were being efficient and making effective use of technology to be efficient and bring their costs down. So I would say that university presses are almost always aware of the potential threat to their existence. They are, after all, not huge commercial enterprises, with a few exceptions. There are Oxford, Cambridge, probably Chicago, are very large presses that really operate on a major commercial scale, like a big commercial trade house in New York City. But the rest of us have to sometimes make do. We make use of the resources we have to the best of our ability. So we're always, always aware of that. And whenever possible, we try to educate our university and their administrators about our value to the university. And as Tom has said, sometimes it's just not generally recognized. It is a matter of having to do this all the time, explain to people that, that whole row of books over there, local Barnes & Noble, is from the University of Missouri Press, or from Truman State, And we have books that sit side by side over there because Truman State also does Missouri history and books about Missouri culture.
Well, I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to Intersection. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungekar. On today's show, we're talking about the future of university publishing. Our guests in the studio today are Claire Wilcox, editor-in-chief of the University of Missouri Press, Nancy Redeker, the director of the Truman State University Press, MU professor of English Tom Quirk. We actually have a caller on the line. Kay, are you there?
I am here, and thanks for taking my call. This is Kay Callison, also known as Kay Bonetti to a lot of people. I have, for 20 years, I had a project called the American Audio Prose Library, in which we interviewed authors, and they did reading performances for us. And the Missouri Review, which is one of the finest literary magazines in the country, published a lot of my interviews in print versions, and the University of Missouri Press published a collection of those interviews. And my concern is this. I just think this was an awful decision all around. But I don't think anybody has mentioned that one service of the university presses is they keep these books in print. Commercial publishers remainder things, like after 6 months, and they go out of print. That's one of the, to me, one of the most valuable things about university presses. And it is my understanding that part of the university's rationale was that the press was costing them so much money. Well, it's my understanding that like $100,000 of that was, and Claire can correct me if I'm wrong, that they made them depreciate their inventory instead of counting it as an asset, as an expense. And that's not right. I mean, I don't think that should be done. The other thing about the Missouri Heritage Series, I heard Claire mention that. For several years, I was a bureaucrat down in Jeff City at the Missouri State Library, and we went one year to the National Book Festival, and we took bazillions of those Missouri Heritage Series books with us to give away at our booth, and they just flew out of there. People from all over the country at other libraries and things saw these and were just amazed by them. And these are books that I understand are written in language that can be read by like eighth grade level readers, I think. And they're very good books about Missouri issues, Missouri history. And those were just a star of that National Book Festival the year I went. And I guess I will shut up now. those were the points I wanted to make.
Claire, can you confirm everything that Kay said, or would you want to issue a comment on that?
I'd rather not, I think, talk about the details of the financial situation at the press.
Okay. Well, we have another comment from our chat room. Thank you for the call, Kay, also.
Oh, sure.
If the university wants to be considered a top-rate research institution, it needs to participate in this system, i.e. publishing scholars. What is the impact on the university's reputation as a research institution? Would the closing of any university press have any bearing on that, even outside of that?
Again, that remains to be seen. But we are a research one institution, and I can't think of any research one institution that doesn't have a press, nor can I think of any state that doesn't have a university press. Maybe University of Alaska, but I'm not certain of that. Alabama and Mississippi. Mississippi, being a very poor state, has quite a fine press. Mm-hmm. It's something that people value, or should, I think.
Well, I just kind of want to go into, are there any precedents for like press closures? Have there been university presses in the past that have closed down? And if so, how have they responded to that?
There have been very few. There have been attempts to close three presses that I know of in fairly recent years, but there was enough of an uproar about the decision, or there was enough and there was enough discussion, public discussion about it before a final decision was made in order to reverse that decision. It happened at the Louisiana State University Press. It happened with the University of Arkansas Press. and one other here recently that I can't think of. But in other cases, the only presses I know that have closed have been very small presses, and in some cases they were merged with another press. Iowa State University Press was closed some, my guess is 12 to 15 years ago. It was really sold. It was sold to Blackwell Publishing, a commercial publisher. And you can still find their imprint out there. I think it's now called Iowa State Press instead of Iowa State University Press. But some of their books are still out there. But it ceased to exist as the university press at that point. But Iowa has another very fine university press in Iowa City, at the University of Iowa Press. So it wasn't as if the state lost its only publisher.
Rice University Press was another one that closed, and then they reopened with just electronic publishing and have since closed, I think, in 2010.
Right. It lasted a couple of years, two or three years, I think, in that form.
Hmm. And in terms of sales, though, how are university presses faring? Who is their primary customer base? And have sales kind of been pretty level over the years, or have they changed?
Well, for us, actually, the sales have been pretty level, even throughout the recession. But we have found that our customer, of course, Borders is out of business, and just some of our wholesalers have the playing field is reshuffling, and so Amazon is the predominant seller in the marketplace these days. Barnes and Noble and Amazon, and so it does change the tactics of what a university press needs to do in order to reach the market in an equitable way, so that we get paid for the books that we put out there, and that brings additional challenges to the press when Amazon is taking a percentage cut, a large percentage off of the books that we publish. It means we have to raise the prices, or we have to depend on our institution to help support the dissemination of scholarly work.
Amazon is the 800-pound gorilla in this case. They can do what they want, and they can charge what they want for the books. Mm-hmm. And they receive the best discount, really, of any. Well, I guess they're an online retailer. I started to say wholesaler, but some of the large wholesalers like Ingram, Baker & Taylor, they also have receive discounts before they resell the books. And because they're so large, they can essentially demand discounts that weren't so drastic in the past. I have to admit that our sales have been a level as well, but it's a constant adjustment all the time to the changing market, to changing discounts, to where your books are going, and most recently electronic publication, Kindle books for the Nook, the Sony e-reader, making those available. And although it's not a large part of our income at this point, it's running about it was about 5% this year of our our net sales was through e-books, and that will only grow, as time goes on. We had an explosion in the purchase of handheld e-book readers over the holidays, and it just seems to be continuing.
Okay. Well, I do want to get more into ebooks after the break, but for now, I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On today's show, we're talking about the future of university publishing. Our guests in the studio today are Claire Wilcox, editor-in-chief of the University of Missouri Press, Nancy Rediger, from the director of the Truman State University Press, and MU professor of English, Tom Quirk. And we'll be back after a short break. I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to Intersection. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungekar. On today's show, we're talking about the future of university publishing. Our guests in the studio today are Claire Wilcox, editor-in-chief of the University of Missouri Press, Nancy Rediger, the director of the Truman State University Press, ME professor of English Tom Quirk, and joining us by phone is Richard Brown. He's the director of the Georgetown University Press and was a former board member of the Association for American University Presses. And for you in our audience, what other recommendations would you have for university presses? Share your thoughts, give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. Now, during the break, we were talking about just different ways university presses could either reduce cost or increase revenue. What are some of those methods you've heard?
Well, one of the ways that one of the changes, again, as we had mentioned, was the advent of ebooks, and that does change the playing field a little bit because libraries are wanting ebooks instead of hardback books, perhaps. So it changes the number of different it changes the formats from hardback to electronic and paperback, which are tend to be less costly, but also they bring in less revenue because hardbacks typically had been priced at a greater price. So we find that we don't have to print as many books because now with short-run digital press, we are able to produce fewer books and quickly. And so you can see what a market is going to do before you have to have large quantities of books printed.
Well, it sounds like that shift towards ebooks is cheaper for research libraries. It's not cheaper for the press.
It's not much cheaper for the press. Most figures I've seen.
No, I have to have it down while I'm on.
75% to 80% of the cost of publishing a book occurs before you even produce it, manufacture it, so that it would cost almost as much to do a digital edition as it would do a print edition. There is some savings there. You don't have to ship the book. Duplication is a lot easier, and you don't have to pay for paper, ink, and binding. But most of the cost that goes into publishing a book starts with the acquisitions process, the peer review process, carries on through the copy editing process, the marketing, and the publicity for the book, and then you still have to distribute that ebook in some fashion. So it's a bit misleading to think that you're going to see drastic savings if you publish in an ebook format. And that's pretty, we found that to be the case. I think it's generally accepted in the industry that probably 75% to 80% lies in before you even get to the point where you're producing a book or an ebook.
And Richard Brown, is that your experience as well? Is Georgetown also moving towards ebooks?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think Claire is right that in terms of the cost of producing ebooks, you do have a savings of roughly 20%, avoiding the paper printing and binding. But Raymond, I want to go back to your question about how to increase sales or increase revenue, because I think that's really a critical question for university presses. It's not just a matter of where can we trim costs. It's really a matter of where can we increase revenue. And I think there are a couple of ways to think about that. One way is in terms of sort of micro. The other is in terms of macro. In terms of micro, what kinds of things are you publishing at the university press? And I think focusing on the classroom, trying to get course adoptions, I think that's really critical for university presses. And I think we're also seeing in terms of the macro strategy, just trying to align our lists editorially with the universities that we're involved with. If Georgetown or Missouri has particular strengths institutionally, the press ought to be reflecting those. And so I think there are a couple of ways to think about increasing revenue and not simply focusing on cutting costs, because that's really not a long-term strategy for survival or sustainability.
Right.
Now, you mentioned classrooms and publishing works geared towards classrooms. The University of Missouri Press does that, correct?
We do, but it's a small part of our list. We don't do textbooks in great quantity. We have some, and we have a very successful one that I mentioned earlier. Textbooks, I agree with Richard that if you can get a book adopted, that's wonderful, and it is a sure source of greater income. But it's also, it has its pitfalls because you're now competing with commercial houses usually. There are plenty of publishers out there who specialize in producing textbooks, and when it comes to marketing those textbooks, they're quite good at it. And they put a lot of money into it, and resources that they have.
Okay, so Richard, what's the benefit then? When you're, if you're potentially competing against commercial publishing houses, what's the benefit of publishing for classrooms?
Right, and just to clarify, when I talk about getting books into the classroom, course adoption books, I'm not really talking about textbooks in the way that the big six publishers publish textbooks. Introduction to Economics, which is 600 pages long, with 3 CDs bound in the back. Mm-hmm. I'm really thinking about books that are considered to be recommended reading or supplemental reading for classes. And those are the books really that university presses are about. I mean, that's what we really publish better than commercial publishers of any stripe. And I think that's where I'm going with this is I think university presses ought to be focusing their editorial programs on which specific scholarly societies do they want to get close with, work with, integrate into, and then provide teaching resources for those scholarly societies. And at Georgetown, for instance, we publish books in Arabic language instruction, and we have for 45 years. We publish books in international affairs. We have for 40 years. And this is a matter of getting close to these scholarly societies, figuring out what it is they need to help them teach their students, and then talking with them, working with them to produce resources and books and monographs and journals that fit into what they need.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of phone calls right now. I guess to start off, we have Ned on the line?
Yes, hello.
Hi, Ned. Do you have a comment?
Yes, it's been touched on a little bit while I've been on hold, but I know that the University of Missouri has talked since they announced they were going to close the press. The administration has talked about the possibility of a new model that would they've made kind of vague allusions to a model that would be based on kind of the Missouri Review, where there's a faculty advisor or two and some interns that would do the editing and would presumably acquire books and so forth. And also they've talked about the importance of moving toward new media and electronic books and digital forms. And I'm calling to ask, I mean, it just doesn't seem like there needs to be an either or there, that if there's a transition toward a new model, that it should be built on the existing press. And I just wonder how that might work and how it's worked elsewhere, how the transition to the digital age is working, how that might be done at Missouri instead of just scrapping everything and starting from scratch.
Okay, well, thanks, Ned. Do you want to take that, Richard? How have other university presses made this transition?
Well, I'm sorry, Raymond. Other university presses?
To increase digital publishing.
Yeah, well, I think every university press right now is engaged in digital publishing and has been for several years. I mean, everybody was in the wave of providing files for Kindle early on and Barnes & Noble's Nook and other platforms. And I think one thing that we really struggle with at university presses is workflow. And I think to take a traditional print workflow at any publisher, whether it's commercial or university press, and to transform that into a digital publishing workflow really has a lot of challenges. And it's not without a lot of costs. And I think one of the things that we're just beginning now to be successful doing at university presses is figuring out the workflow and trying to do some coding of digital files early on in the process, so they're much more flexible and malleable and can be used and poured into different platforms. And so I think that's the commitment we all have to make as university presses, is it really has become a digital world. And I agree with the caller. I don't think it's a matter of just blowing it up and then starting over. I think we can adapt the organizations and the workflows we have now, but we really need to make a commitment to converting that workflow into a digital workflow, not simply a print workflow.
I would just like to add that at Truman State University Press a year ago, we did learn how to create our own electronic books, and that has been extremely helpful. It actually helped us be more efficient in the way we process our, way we produce our print books as well. And we are now able to, after we get the print book off to our printer, then we finish up and produce our electronic book. And then we are directly distributing those to the two various companies. We had at first tried to outsource 20 of our backlists to get them done by another company, translate them into ebooks. And the quality was very sporadic. Some were excellent quality and some were not. So we were running into issues like that when it was outsourced. But I think it helps us to be, we're flexible now by being able to produce our own ebooks. It allows us to have some flexibility in where we will go with it in the future, where the future of publishing will go, because we are able to do that, work with the ebook files.
So, I mean, given that there's some inconsistency with when you outsource in terms of the ebooks, are more presses kind of going to in-house ebook publishing or creation?
I think I've had several inquiries about the company we used. I've had several inquiries from other university presses, University of Nebraska Press, and actually the University of Chicago Press, about using them for their own resource. And so I think the trend is to for university presses to bring it in-house and learn how to do electronic publishing in-house.
Okay. We have another caller, John from Cincinnati.
Yes, I teach history at the University of Cincinnati. I'm a Truman Scholar, and one of the points I'd like to bring up is that there is no other university press that really covers the Truman administration with the breadth and the depth that the Missouri press has done. To lose them really would be a great blow to Truman scholarship, and it also occurs to me that this seems to be a very odd thing for Missouri to do to one of its native sons, perhaps its most famous native son. There's another area that they're very good in that I think is also irreplaceable, and that is that they have done a lot with Civil War and Missouri. And again, I don't see any other press of the same scale and size. Missouri picked the ball up on that issue as well. And finally, I think it takes years of tradition and experience to create a press like the University of Missouri Press. And I think anybody who thinks they can just recreate this in some other form, that they're really missing the boat. That's not going to be possible. This is a gem that really needs to be preserved.
Okay, well, thank you for the comment, John.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, well, I do want to go back to ebooks, though, and the complications of developing an in-house ebook publishing core. I guess what obstacles did you encounter initially?
Perhaps a little resistance to tackling it. But for the most part, it actually has made our process more efficient. And so we are able, even though we are a very small press, we have 3 full-time staff and 1 part-time staff member, we are able to actually do more with the ebook process. So what is the downside? Not too much. And it puts the files in our control so that we don't have to scour through them and make sure they're okay when we were out, like we had to when we were outsourcing them. I guess the one downside would be that we don't have control over the distribution because we can't just put them up on our website at this point because our university doesn't have digital rights management protection so that the files can't, if we just put them up on our website, they could be pirated, for instance. So we do have to go through a distributor to help us distribute electronic books, or in the case of Amazon, we post them to an Amazon site with DRM protection. So that it's more in the distribution end than in the production end that we've run into a few obstacles, but even those aren't too bad.
Okay. I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungekar. On today's show, we're talking about the future of university publishing. Our guests in the studio today are Claire Wilcox, editor-in-chief of the University of Missouri Press, Nancy Redeker, the director of the Truman State University Press, MU professor of English Tom Quirk, and joining us by phone is Richard Brown. He's the director of the Georgetown University Press and former board member of the Association for American University Presses. And for you and our audience, what do you think of this push towards digital publishing? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. Before that break, Nancy had mentioned concerns over piracy. Richard, is that have you been hearing that among other publishers?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a real headache for every publisher publishing digital books, whether you're commercial or university press, large or small. We just have not found an adequate solution to digital piracy, and it's rampant. There are some programs now, commercial programs, that are anti-piracy programs that you can buy on an annual basis. You subscribe to these services. They will do searches of your book, tell you who's posting your books illegally. Pirate Bay is one site where there are a lot of university press books. And they'll send takedown notices, and they will gather information. If you eventually want to slap a lawsuit on these pirate sites, but the fact is, these are very expensive services, and a lot of smaller university presses simply can't pay $25,000 a year for an anti-pirate service. So we need to find a solution, but it absolutely is something that all of us are wrestling with, and I'm very much hoping we can have a cost-effective solution to these digital piracy sites, which are just proliferating like rabbits right now.
Okay. Well, what other trends are we seeing within the publishing world? I suppose another thing is print on demand. What is that?
Well, or short run digital printing as well, which is a variant of that, I suppose. But it allows us to keep inventory down, levels down, so that you don't overstock a book. You simply stock less, and then you reprint more often. This gives us much greater flexibility. And again, this is an outgrowth of fairly new technology, or it's recently become less expensive, and the quality of the printing has improved to the point that we can do this. I did want to mention another use of technology that we've seen, and for me is very exciting, even though it isn't my area, and that is the use of electronic means in marketing to get the word out there about books, to use the internet to promote and market these books. It's proved to be a wonderful tool. Also, the ability of marketing departments to communicate almost instantly information about their books to their wholesalers, their retailers, their sales reps out there selling the books, or book review editors. You know, there's the internet and digital technology has really improved marketing drastically, I would say, in the last 5 or 7 years.
Mm. And are we seeing similar types of collaborations around other presses among different regions? Richard, do you want to take that?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is a lot of collaboration going on, and I think it's clear that even the largest university presses can't go it alone. And traditionally, some of the larger university presses have provided distribution services and even marketing services for smaller university presses. But there's also collaboration going on between presses and their parent institutions and between their libraries. And I think that's really interesting direction we're going right now. For instance, at UNC, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the press and the university have collaborated on a civil rights series, the Long Civil Rights Movement, which is a really interesting multimedia program. At Minnesota, publishing a quadrant, which is a publishing collaboration between the press and the university's Institute for Advanced Study. Harvard and California are offering publishing services for their campuses. The University of Georgia Press is working with the Georgia Humanities Council to produce the new Georgia Encyclopedia, which is an online encyclopedia. So this kind of collaboration, I think we are just seeing the tip of the iceberg here, and we really, it's not only interesting editorially in terms of what we're producing, but in terms of our business models in the future, it's going to be a necessity. We're all going to have to figure out how we can collaborate together and ultimately share a cause.
Well, I'm just looking at our chat room right now, and there's a lot of conversation comparing declines in research spending by public research universities with increases in football spending. Would anyone like to comment on that? Just, if not here nationally, are we seeing a decline in the importance of university presses?
You know, we aren't seeing a decline in their importance, that's for sure. I don't want to compare it to an athletic department budget, but the need for university presses hasn't declined. They need to go through some changes, some of those Richard just pointed out. And fortunately, there are some resources out there. The Mellon Foundation has given grants for cooperative efforts among university presses for a variety of projects. It's hardly true that university presses are less important now than they've ever been.
Okay. Well, another trend I've been hearing about is open access publishing. Mm-hmm. What is that? Richard, do you want to take that?
Sure. And open access is a very slippery term. I think one way to think about open access is that there are ways that culture in the academy right now are getting more and more information online, and there's an expectation that research results, whether it's in the sciences or humanities or social sciences, ought to be made available more quickly and more easily. I think that's the zeitgeist that we're in right now. And so open access, which really has been going on for some time, is a matter of opening up access. And it's also a matter of redistributing costs, because the costs can't run and hide. The costs are still going to be there. But in certain fields, particularly in the hard sciences, there have been movements afoot to try to make sure that especially federally funded research is made available as quickly as possible and as easily as possible to a wide audience, and not simply at the university, but also the broader culture. So you've got open access, which is a movement for opening up access to scholarly research, but it's also a very slippery term, as I say, because you have to be precise about what you mean with opening up more access. There are hybrid models right now, for instance, of open access that some university presses have, where they are providing journal articles for free. They are putting some monographs online for free at the University of Pittsburgh Press, for instance. These are openly accessible to people, but that's a hybrid model, and there are also pay models that go alongside that, where you need to pay for multiple articles of particular journals or multiple monographs. And it's just a movement right now that is in its infancy, and we are all getting involved in opening up access to our research.
Okay. Well, we only have a couple of more minutes, but I just kind of want to explore that. What incentive would a press have to adopt that model? I mean, you're getting the information out there, but aren't you losing potential revenue that you
right.
could attain?
Right, and I'm sure Richard would have gotten to the problem of cost recovery, and I think he was implying that the money is going to have to come from somewhere. There were some early arguments years ago, and I still hear it now, that opening up access actually enhances sales of say your print titles or even some of the digital titles. I know that Michael Jensen at the National Academies Press has advocated that for years, but recently I think he's been forced to admit that they probably aren't doing as well as they might do because they're giving away books, that it isn't necessarily a better business model, but it's one that they seem to be getting by with, and they can say that they value open access in that sense.
Okay, and once again, we just have a couple of more minutes left. I want to go around the table and kind of just ask what we can expect to see in the future in terms of adopted models for academic publishing. Richard, what can we expect to see in the coming years?
I think a few things. One is more aggregation. By aggregation, I mean that more and more presses are going to put more and more book and journal content together in digital libraries to enable better research. And that's happening right now, and I think we'll see more and more of that. Another thing we're going to see is more and more chunking, ironically. That is chunking up chapters, providing chapters for sale, sections for sale, and not just having a 300-page book, but rather selling and making available 25-page chapters. And then the last thing I'll mention is, I think, multimedia mashups. I think that's coming soon at university presses, where you're going to have enhanced ebooks with video and various multimedia platforms, and you'll have content, not simply books or journals, that will provide information to different scholarly disciplines.
Have we seen any types of, university presses release any type of these multimedia mashups? What are some notable cases?
Princeton Shorts is the most recent example I can think of pulling out a segment and selling something separately in a short piece from a larger work. And there are also a lot of experiments in the kinds of digital mashups that Richard's talking about. I think Media Commons might be an example. Is that the sort of thing you're thinking of, Richard?
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. But they're all in an experimental stage. And the most recent book I've seen that advocates that sort of thing is probably Kathleen Fitzpatrick's book, Planned Obsolescence. Mm-hmm. But even she admits that in the long run, the cost is still there, that it isn't going to save you any money to do it that way. And what I hope is that people realize that there's still a place for the single-authored, full-length study on a particular scholarly topic, that it doesn't become a matter of not having an author anymore in the case of a sort of digital mashup or the kinds of publishing models that might be based on blogs, which have their purpose. But I don't think that's any reason to supplant the traditional scholarly monograph.
Okay, well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. I just wanted to to thank all of our guests and all of our chat room participants for the lively discussion. I want to thank our guests, Claire Wilcox, Nancy Rediger, Tom Quirk, and Richard Brown. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of all our programs each Monday afternoon online and by going to kbia.org and clicking the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to stream video, submit questions and comments, and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's show is produced by Janet Saidi. Travis McMillan is our technical director, with production assistance from Danny Madison. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungekar.